Good evening, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls because we have with us Dr. Joe Douglas, and we're going to be talking tonight about a subject I think is so vitally important, and that is mind control. The techniques that have been developed to control what the American people think. Now, I was just reading today where we have programs that are being broadcast in Arabic to the people of Iraq, and Afghanistan. They're on Arabic television over there, but they're actually coming, of course, from American-controlled stations, probably CIA, and, of course, we're giving the news we want them to get. We are trying to influence their thoughts, control what they think. Of course, I'm sure, win them around to our side to believe that we are there to help them establish some sort of a democratic society. Only a time, every time anybody talks about a one-man, one-vote situation, why we pretty much unhappy with that. But let's get back to what's going on here in America, because Dr. Joe Douglas has been studying this for some time. Dr. Douglas, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you again, Dr. Stan.
Well, why don't you just to sort of introduce this idea and why you got interested in mind control in America?
Well, of course, mind control is one of the most distasteful things that any of us can think about, sort of characterized by the novels of like Brave New World or 1984, which create quite a stir when you try and really imagine a world in which people, their minds really aren't their own but are controlled by other people through chemistry and other means. I got into this quite accidentally, as a matter of fact. I'd been working for years with a very high level defector, the highest person ever to come from the communist world, General Major Jan Sena. And we were talking about a variety of things, and one day a friend of mine asked me, you know, here's a journalist, a person big in the news area, and he goes over to the Soviet Union. He was very conservative before he went over, and he comes back, and he's a liberal. You know, what happens? Those guys have some type of a funny chemical they give them to change their minds. And that got me thinking, because I recalled another friend of mine who was heavily involved in the atomic bomb projects, and he talked about a number of atomic scientists who were among the top scientists on that project, and they went over to the Soviet Union and came back, and all of a sudden they were anti-war and sort of regretted their work on the bomb, and he always referred to it as... they went over and they smelt the peace gas. And this got my curiosity up, because the person who was concerned about this reporter that went over to the Soviet Union and came back with totally changed views asked me if they had some type of a drug that they could use to change people's minds. I hadn't really thought about it until that time, and when he mentioned this, I went to my friend who was the top-ranking defector that I'd mentioned before and asked him if they had something like this. And he said, of course. He said they'd worked on it very hard, and I was part of the program. And then he started to really give me the whole nine yards, and this is what really keyed my interest into this field.
All right, fine. Will you hold that thought? We'll be back here in just a moment. As we begin to develop this, these concepts, that there are people who've worked for many years on how to control the reality of the public, of individuals, by drugs, by conditioning, by suggestion. There are all sorts of techniques. They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want us to know what they're doing. We'll be right back. Well, our guest this evening is Dr. Joe Douglas. We're talking about mind control. A few years ago, there was a program. It was on very popular on television. It was called The Pretender, and it was the story of a little boy who had been kidnapped by some organization. Now, you didn't know who it was, but you knew somehow it was affiliated with government. And, of course, he was subjected to all sorts of experiments and, of course, stimulated and traumatized till he became extremely brilliant. And he had tremendous talent that had been programmed into him. He could become almost anybody, a surgeon. He could become ventriloquist. He could do anything he really wanted to. He had this ability, and of course the story was always it ended with a chase. Do such things really happen in the real world? Well, Dr. Douglas, why don't we get back to the story of Major General Senyan, who was a major general in the Czechoslovakian army, who told you what he knew about some of these experiments.
This is true. Now, up until this time, I was aware of a CIA project, one of many that had gotten some notoriety during the mid-70s, and this was called the MKUltra program. And there were, you know, probably a dozen other programs of similar names that were also exposed at the same time, focused on mind control.
Bluebird, Artichoke, similar, right?
Yes, MKDelta, Delta, MK Search,
Naomi, right.
A whole bunch of them. There were never any real strong details on what these programs what they actually did, and there was a lot of conjecture and a lot of people wringing their hands and throwing up their hands about the whole thing, but nobody really had any data on what was accomplished, and for good reason that we can get into later on. You know, one of the peculiar things about this, Dr. Stan, that I've run into, I think it's amazing in a way, but when there's no real data, you have a tremendous interest in the rumors area. And if people will write on it, and they'll pick it up, and they'll run with it, and they'll repeat it, and it sort of spreads like wildfire. But what struck me is when I started working with SANA, we weren't talking about rumors. We weren't talking about hearsay. We weren't talking about deductions. He started laying out the whole process of the Soviet interests, which utilized the Czechs considerably in developing these drugs and how they were being used in operations. And as I started gathering in the material on their objectives and what they were capable of doing after being in the program really about 20 years, it was just mind-boggling. And as I started talking about this to some people...
Hold that thought for just a minute, Joe. We'll be right back with the station. All right, fine. Our guest, Dr. Joe Douglas, and we're talking about mind control. Please pick up your story.
As I was talking to people and giving a number of talks, and I wrote some papers on this, about what the Soviets actually accomplished, it was like there was just deathly silence. Nobody wanted to pick up with it and run with it, I guess, and nobody cared to repeat it. It just sort of laid there and gathered dust. And it strikes me that maybe one of the problems is that it's fun to talk about something that sort of there's rumors and you conjecture about it, but when somebody really starts throwing out actual details, the frightening aspect of the problem just rises, you know, several orders of magnitude, and people go into almost a mode of denial to really confront the whole project.
Well, of course, I think it's very hard for most people to imagine that there is the degree of evil out there that there really is. And yet, of course, not to recognize it may seal the doom of this nation.
That's true. You know, one of the people that really discussed this, and in not any detail, but he sort of captured the essence of the problem, I think, was Alan Dulles. And, of course, the program blossomed under Dulles, who was became head of the CIA in 1953, and he gave a talk about a few weeks after he'd become director to some Princeton alumni on what he called brain warfare. And it was interesting because he talked about how the Russians were using brain perversion techniques as a main weapon in prosecuting the Cold War. And then what he said was, I thought, was really sort of explained the problem. He said, some of these techniques are so subtle and so abhorrent to our way of life that we have recoiled from facing up to them. And that indeed is what we have done doing, what we have been doing, recoiling from facing up to what the Russians have been doing, and even more so, recoiling from letting anybody know what the CIA has been up to.
Because, of course, the C1A wanted to know what the Russians were doing and what they could accomplish. So they carried out very, very similar experiments.
They did. And it's very interesting, you know, in looking at the MK Ultra material, what little has been released, one of the things that jumps out is here is a massive effort. It is so secret and so abhorrent to our view in the way of life. It's even programmed in a project, MK Ultra, which is specifically designed so as to leave no paper trails, to use a wholly new approach to accounting methods so that nobody would able to be to understand what was happening, and to have no records kept so that anybody could ever find out what was done.
Well, I think that one interesting thing is that all the records were to be destroyed, but they forgot one box of them. And sometime later, in the probably the early 1970s, somebody sent a Freedom of Information request in. Oh, a very efficient CIA official found that box of records, copied them, and sent them to an individual. And that became the basis of the Church Committee hearings. The CIA hoped that nobody would ever find out the evil things that they had done.
That's true. And then they had a Freedom of Information Act request, and lo and behold, they came up with about 16,000 pages, which is now up to about 20,000. And most of it is junk, you know. But there's a few documents that got in there that's very interesting. And one of the curious ways is the manner in which this program is described in its early years within internal CIA documents, including one of the IG reports. It's the Inspector General reports on the area. And the type of words that they were using to describe the program was distasteful, unethical, illicit. It would jeopardize careers if anybody learned about it. And they had to have special security measures because of what they recalled serious repercussions in political and diplomatic circles if anybody learned about its taking place. You know, this is the type of work we were doing, so sensitive that they made it so that there was no accountability, and it was designed so that nobody could really hold them accountable or even learn what they did, or at least that's what their own papers talk about. And when you really look at the objectives, the ones that were laid out in some of those early documents, it's kind of easy to understand. And let me just run through a few of their objectives. Promote illogical thinking and impulsiveness to the point where the person, the target, would discredit himself. Render the induction of hypnosis very easy. Produce shock and confusion in people's mind. Alter personality structure. Diminish ambition and working efficiency. Promote illogical thinking. Produce physical disablement, such as anemia and paralysis. Enhance the tendency of one person to become dependent upon another. Now, it's interesting. These are all, you know, how do we create mental illness in a person is another way to describe it. And, of course, one of the things that they were very afraid of and that led to this IG report was the concern over the tremendous use which was being made of human guinea pigs, including Americans, without their knowledge. This was going on not only in America but in many other countries as well. On people in prisoners, on prisoners of war, at exactly a time when we were supposedly complaining about this type of work being done by others on our prisoners, and most notably about the whole crimes that were paraded before the world at Nuremberg.
Well, you're absolutely right. In fact, we carry a book here called Operation Bluebird, and I think you have it. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it yet, but it's written by a psychiatrist who had the job or the opportunity to deal with a number of people who had dissociative personalities. In other words, these were multiple personalities, and these were people who had been experimented on by the Central Intelligence Agency to create mental illness in them. And this is the most incredible book, because this is a very reliable physician who's written a number of peer-reviewed papers, but this book is based upon reading, I don't know, 20 or 30,000 pages of CIA documents, maybe 20,000, and, you know, and realizing that they knew exactly what they were doing, and they talked openly about this among themselves. But then they could never let the American people know that they were, of course, creating illness, but they could justify this. Why we have to do this, because, after all, we have to know what the Russians can find out about how the human mind works. And, of course, that's why that program I mentioned earlier, The Pretender, was so important, because that was exactly the same thing they actually did on American citizens, and created this tremendous capacity for remembering and ability, but also the dissociative personalities, so you would become multiple personalities, and many of these people would not recognize what the other personality was doing.
That's true, and there are several books that have been written by people who were presumably part of this program, and this, they read like a horror story, all of them. There was, of course, the famous case of some people that found out what was happening as a result of the way in which their parents were treated up at the by Dr. Cameron up in Montreal at the institute he ran in McGill.
Could you tell that story? I think that is one of the most incredible and frightening stories of what happened to a woman who had a minor depression, went to the hospital thinking she was going to be treated, never having any idea what lay ahead for her.
Oh, the treatment that they gave her almost read like a manual from the Chinese brainwashing, where they would use sleep deprivation, temperature controls over a person, isolation from all types of sound, all of these types of things which would really be extremely serious to a person and their personality, including electroshock as well. And they just, they didn't obviously have any good results with a woman in terms of curing her illness, but they certainly created a lot worse cases.
Well, what they did is they wiped out her memory. They kept her asleep for weeks on at a time. And they would, then they would use the electric shock 20 or 30 or 50 times what you would ordinarily use. And to this very day, even though she's gotten $1 million from the Canadian government for this macabre experiment, she can't remember anything at all.
No, and of course, one of their objectives in this and many other tests were to learn how they could possibly selectively erase a person's memory.
Right.
So they could question somebody who they had caught, and then make it so the person could not remember anything about the whole affair, which was something they thought would be very good to have.
Now, well, that was part of the process of making multiple personalities, but the average individual has never heard these things because, of course, with the degree of control that exists over the major media, you're not going to hear about the books, and yet, of course, we carry a great deal of this information through our ministry. We do carry Operation Bluebird. We certainly carry the MK Ultra report that came out of the church committee. All of this information is there, but you're not going to find this at your local library.
No, there's quite a few things that are very good, and you have certainly one of the best collection that exists on books that are very hard to find in this area. There's another reason also why people haven't heard, and that's because as people would find out, and they'd take the CIA to court, and the minute it looked like they were going to be able to produce something or succeed in something, the CIA would immediately settle out of court. And the agreement, of course, was that the person wouldn't acknowledge what the settlement was, and that all the papers related to the court would be sealed so that nobody could hear about them or see them. And, of course, that has been a wonderful legal ploy with which has managed to keep this whole thing bottled up, as you well know.
Because the use of LSD, certainly by, on unsuspecting people. In fact, Timothy Leary, we have associated with that. But Leary readily admitted that much of this, of course, was CIA. The CIA was behind pushing this LSD onto our unsuspecting people. And, of course, some of these people had a very bad trip, like jumping out of a window 30 stories up in the air. A lot of that's covered in a new book called Harvard and the Unabomber, the story of Ted Kaczynski. He was the victim of the CIA mind control program at Harvard University, and we know how that ended up. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. Joe Douglas. The book I'm referring to, Harvard and the Unabomber, by Alliston Chase, I think. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. Joe Douglas, who's certainly worked back in Washington, D.C., and in and out of government for many years. But, of course, he's been researching, well, a number of things. And one of them, of course, has been mind control. And he was actually told by Major General Senya, who was one of the highest officials in the Czech Army and really in the Czech Communist Party, how they actually developed, at least the Russians developed, these drugs that were so useful for mind control. You pick up the story there, please.
I certainly will. The Czechs first got involved in this effort during the, really, in a serious way, during the Korean War, because that's when they were instructed to build a hospital in North Korea for experimentation on U.S. Servicemen who were captured. And one of the things they used them for was as guinea pigs in testing mind control drugs. In particular, you know, many people, and particularly people that are our age, Dr. Stan, can remember some of the newsreels of our servicemen following the Korean War, where they were talking about, they were still captive over in North Korea, but they were on the newsreel as though they were free, and they were extolling the virtues of communism and decrying the false promises of capitalism as it existed in the United States. And as it was explained to me by General Sena, that these soldiers were really the result of operations with the Czech, what he referred to as their friendship drug, which would cause people to be able to mold it in terms of their opinions so as to change their opinions. And this drug was also used on some very strong anti-communists and high-level officials from some East European countries that didn't want anything to do with the Soviets. But after a week in Czechoslovakia at a conference and being fed the drug and then squeezed, as Jan referred to it, the pressure put on them with respect to different political positions, particularly the Soviet Union, were they bad guys or good guys, these people suddenly in a week they were regarding the Russians as friends and the Soviets not with any animosity anymore. Give you an idea of which the manner in which they changed. Another good example that many people will recall was the trial of Cardinal Menzanti in Hungary. And as you recall, he confessed to a wide variety of crimes that he never would have confessed to had there not been something that was used. But it was clear that he hadn't been the subject of usual type of brainwashing because of the manner of his personality and his behavior during the trial. And that was one of the things that really got the CIA particularly concerned on the Soviet development in drugs. And as it turns out, they're absolutely right. I was talking to Jan about the Cardinal Menzanti trial, and he said that very definitely that the friendship drugs or confession drugs were used on him, and that they were also used on one of the Czech leaders, Josef Smrkovsky, who was then sent to prison for all sorts of malfeasance in office, which he confessed to after about 2 days' applications of these confession drugs that were fed to him by the intelligence agents. And he also then implicated a number of other Czech officials, high officials, who were also sent to prison and after their confessions were secured. But we went over many of these types of examples, and let me just give you a feel for the actual drugs. Now, these are not objectives that we're talking about here, but these were actual drugs that the Soviets had developed before Jan defected, which was in 1968, and he provided...
Hold that thought right there. Okay, Dr. Stan back here. I guess Dr. Joe Douglas, and he was just been talking about how the Soviets had developed these mind control drugs, how a Major General Senyum had told him about how these were used on political representatives, on Cardinal Mazzetti, and many on other people get confessions out of them that they would never have confessed to ordinarily. But when your mind has been taken over by these drugs, you'll say whatever you're told to say. So pick up the story from there.
Yeah, some of these, as a matter of fact, also, Dr. Stan, because of the heavy use of our American prisoners who are missing in the drug development program.
Now you're talking about the POWs who were actually taken to Russia and were used experimentally, and our government has concealed that fact from the American people. The last thing they ever wanted was for the American people to find out that many of our prisoners were taken to Russia, because of course then we'd have to hold these people accountable for war crimes, and we would never want to do that. In fact, we've done everything we could to, in many respects, help the Russians maintain their military capacity, always finding some excuse or another to transfer important technology to the Russians, or, oh, shucks, we just didn't know what we were doing, it was a mistake. It wasn't a mistake. We knew exactly what we were doing. And the tragic thing is there have been so many atrocities against Americans, and it's all been suppressed, including, as Dr. Douglas has pointed out in his book, Betrayed, and if you haven't read it, you should, the fact that we abandoned 20 to 25,000 American servicemen after the Second World War, 8,000 after the Korean War, and many thousand after Vietnam, and that is still being actively concealed from the American people, and many of these people were taken to Russia. In fact, there's a book called Moscow Bound. I'm sure you know that book, don't you?
Oh, it's an excellent book. It's the best in the POW area. It's the most complete, written by John M.G. Brown, one of the first books to really come out and provide all the data on it. It's the Bible of the POW MIA area.
And I've tried to get Mr. Brown to come on my program, and he said, no, nobody cares. And he was so depressed when I talked to him, I almost wanted to weep. But he's given so much, and then to realize that the American people really don't care.
Yeah, the reason I brought this up, Dr. Stan, is because of the interrelation between the development of mind control drugs and the use of our prisoners as guinea pigs. This explains why nobody wants to look for the prisoners of war. And the topic itself is so horrendous that you really have to see it in print. And I'm not just talking about these things, because I've described every single one of them with all the details in the book Betrayed. Matter of fact, the first third of it could really be a separate book just on mind control. But I started to sort of give you an idea of the drugs which we had talked about, and which I've produced all sorts of examples that Sana had firsthand knowledge of in the book, so that people could really understand the implications of these things. But he had drugs that we've talked about to turn enemies into friends. They had ones that were very effective in loosening tongues so that people would talk freely and in such a way that they'd have no recollection of it afterwards, sort of an amnesia regarding what they did. They had ones that would be given to people, all this being done, of course, covertly, to create very pliable negotiators. The ones that would cause people to become very aggressive, to the point of even killing themselves if they were a pilot, say, or a plane driver of some sort. Ones that would cause people to be confused. Another one, which would be disastrous if you can think about it, that would cause people to speak their minds without thinking of the consequences. Think of what happens when that's given to a political candidate for office. Ones that would destabilize people and promote chaotic behavior. To disrupt a person's ability to think logically, to cause leaders to shift directions constantly, not able to focus in one direction or keep in the same direction. Drugs that would demoralize people, give them a defeatist attitude, ones that would cause people to become paranoid. Now, these are very specifics, but you can see how similar they are, in a sense, to the objectives the Americans had, which we then claim we accomplished nothing after 20 years of research. And that's one of the curious things. When you look at the MK-Ultra program, when you look at the Soviet program, one of the great values of Betrayed in this material, is you see the tremendous accomplishments of the Soviets, And at the same time, you see the United States with a tremendous effort, yet, according to the CIA officials, accomplishing absolutely nothing.
But you know what's so interesting, Dr. Douglas, is they did everything they could to discredit Major General Senya and everything he said so that nobody would believe his story. And you wonder why.
Absolutely. And, of course, it's they really don't want anybody to know or to hear or to believe, not only General Senya, but any of these defectors who have come over that really knew how things were and what the scoop really was, either politically or how they worked in their intelligence area.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. Joe Douglas, who we've had on many, many times on our programs. Dr. Douglas has written a wonderful book called Betrayed, which we do carry. It's available through Radio Liberty. If you'd like more information, our telephone number 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. But we're talking about, of course, the use of drugs by the Russians as they developed them, and then the fact that we were carrying out similar mind control experiments right here in the United States, and I'm sure working in concert with our friends over at the Tavistock Institute over in Great Britain, and with other countries and with other central intelligence agencies, because all of the intelligence agencies of the world work together, sort of a brotherhood of darkness, you might say. So let's get back to what the other things that you learned about mind control, Dr. Douglas.
Well, let me give you a couple of case examples, because these really sort of bring home the problem we're talking about. During the 1960s, the British, if you recall, I forget the year, I think it might have been about 1967, or between 64 and 67, they devalued the pound. And talking to Jan Senya, he said, yes, we knew they were going to devalue the pound a week before they did it. And he said, we didn't do anything because the Soviets were a little bit concerned that it might be a deception. But I was in Bulgaria, I guess it was, and he's talking about himself and a number of other Czech officials, and they had lunch with Tudor Zivkov, who was the president, a very heinous individual. And he said, he explained it to us over lunch, how they got the information. He said, all we did was give them some British bankers who were over visiting us a little pill at lunch, and this top British official told them all about the plans to devalue the pound. And that was the way it came about. And he had a little thing. I mean, Senya remembered it very, very clearly. He said, Zivkov said, you know, sometimes we are very conservative. I do not have to recruit a bank president. There's enough for me to have dinner with him. I just sit back and let him tell us about the British financial plans. And that's all it was to it, with this pill. And the pill was of such a nature that it was also had that substance in it, which would also cause the person to have amnesia and not remember what he'd done. Another one that's, I think, a beautiful example. This is one of those drugs I mentioned where it loosens a person's tongue and in the sense of making them uninhibited about talking about things.
Hold that right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Joe Douglas, and we've been talking about the things that Major General Senya told him about how the Russians had specific drugs that would, first of all, make people talk, and then, of course, would make them forget that they'd told what they were doing. And so it was very easy to get even high officials having dinner with a Russian official to tell the Russians the things that ordinarily, under normal circumstances, they wouldn't, so they actually found drugs that would really unlock the mind. So pick up the story from there, Dr. Douglas.
One of the delightful examples that Jan used was of a defense council meeting where the Czech minister in charge of intelligence brought along his deputy, Husky, to be sort of a little guinea pig and provide an example of them. And they had a break for tea, and during that time, he was given this tea that had a drug put into the tea without Husky's knowledge. And after the coffee break, Jan said, or the president, Novotny, was running the meeting, said, okay, now, comrades, we have to finish our schedule. And then this person who was visiting, the deputy, all of a sudden raised his hand and said, how about if we have a free discussion? Because there are many things that never reach the defense counsel in the papers you are given. There are many things you never see. For example, take the case where you made a decision to get the West German government to resign. As all of us know, the government did not resign. There was a scandal. But the final result, a collapse, never happened, and nobody asked why. And at this point, Jan said, you know, he said his friend, Minister of Interior, became very concerned and interrupted Husky before he went too far. And stopped him and said, Husky, let's not discuss foreign operations here. And the guy quickly responded, you see, even for this higher body, there are no secrets that you are told. There are secrets you are not told. And John had a chuckle about that, because this is an actual event that happened, but it showed how somebody here that has something like this talks about some things that are on his mind that he never would have dreamt about talking about had he been himself. But here he goes out and starts talking about these things, and he would have been fired and thrown in the can if he had ever tried something like that in normal practice. But it was a good example. Another beautiful example is the every now and then you'd have a U.S. congressional delegation. And one of the things they would do one evening, with they were sitting around, and you know, in the interest of friendship, with a little glass of wine and with the delegates, and they would give them some of these loosen-the-tongue drugs. And Jan said they all started talking freely. And what they would do is they were talking more than anything else. Of course, they would lead them into talking about the proclivities and all the scandals involving their bosses. And not only what the policies were, which they usually did individually, but as a collective, they were sort of, you know, just a playful session on who knows the most dirt about the various congressmen and senators. And he said it was really funny. He says all the stories came out, and it was like everybody competed with somebody else to tell an even worse story about their boss. So, you know, all of this material, of course, was tape recorded and used for compromise and blackmail purposes later on. Again, an example of how these drugs can be applied in an actual operation, the types of things you never, ever hear about. And we never would have either, except for the tremendous efforts of Jan Sena to help, to provide this information. Unfortunately, nobody in the intelligence community ever wanted him to talk. They didn't want this information. Can you believe that? They didn't want to know these types of things and what the Soviets were doing in mind control drugs.
Well, I'm sure that it wasn't that they didn't want to know. They don't think they wanted this to go on record, because once it was on record, then they might be asking about some of the things that we were doing and some of the experiments that we were carrying out. And many of these, of course, were really revealed in those MKUltra hearings. Of course, the press really didn't give you too much, but we actually have the complete hearings. We offer that through Radio Liberty. And it's frightening to think what they did to Americans.
And it's really appalling that Congress really, they just sort of brushed over the thing and published some documents that very few people read, but they never really dug into what we had accomplished, what programs were actually successful, and what was actually being done with the drugs that we have developed. You know, they tried to put forth the idea that we never accomplished a thing in terms of the top official documents, and indeed that most of the materials had been deliberately destroyed. But one of the things that one of the documents that didn't get destroyed points out, that within 4 years of the start of MKUltra, they had 6 drugs that they were using in operations and had already used them on 33 different people. And that like 2 years later, that number had climbed to 100 different operations. Well, you have to stop and ask, you know, how many operations had they really used these things with, and how many different drugs did they have, say, by 1968? And how could they possibly say, well, we never really accomplished anything or did anything other than feed a little bit of LSD to some unsuspecting people.
Well, you know, we hear a lot now about we've captured Sheikh Khalid Muhammad. He was the man who planned the World Trade Center, and he is being questioned somewhere by the CIA. Well, you know very well they're using drugs on him to get the information from him. Even Saddam Hussein, or at least the man who supposedly we captured, Saddam Hussein, has been giving a great deal of information about the operation of the Iraqi underground. Now, why would he do a thing like that? Unless, of course, he was under the influence of drugs, that he had no control over what he was doing. So I suspect that all of the terrorists that we're capturing, they're using these drugs to get all the information. I think that we probably have almost totally destroyed the Islamic terrorist movement. But after all, if we told the American people that, how would we justify continuing the war on terrorism and the Patriot Act and the Office of Homeland Security and the massive expansion of federal government control here in this country? So all I can say is I think they've done a great job. We haven't had one major attack in the United States since September 11th. If the terrorists are really such a factor, such a danger to America, why haven't we had any major attacks here? I think that we've just totally disrupted their movement, and I suspect that when we do get these prisoners, why they are given drugs, and they, of course, reveal all the other people that are out there. Certainly, the Russians had the ability to do that, didn't they?
Oh, yes. And the question in my mind is then, well, we know they're using them on other people. Are they using them on our own people? Are they used against political opponents to make it so they're a less effective political opponent? Are they used on people within the Congress, for example, or on business executives or other people that they want to give donations to the party?
Well, somebody's given
used in hundreds of ways.
Somebody's given an awful lot of money to the current Republican campaign, over $150 million. They're going for $200. That's an awful lot of money. That buys an awful lot of ads, an awful lot of influence. But maybe they just, of course, want to be in good terms with the current administration.
And, of course, you know, going back to the Soviet Union as an example of what can happen, when Andropov took over the KGB, one of the first things that he did was to lobby very effectively with the aid of Suslov to bring all of the mind control drug work, and particularly the casework, the actual operations, under his exclusive control. Before that, they were not. All the secretaries and the key departments had a say over their use when they were used in an area that influenced their department's operations. And indeed, Ponomaryov, who was the head of International Department and key in foreign relations, was almost a co-director of the mind control drug program. And as a result of Andropov's lobbying, all of that got them taken away from all of the departments and put under the exclusive control of the KGB, who, among other things, recognized quite clearly that this could be used against their own people, and I suspect is the main way in which Andropov himself was then chosen as the general secretary in 1982, I believe. The Soviets would never have put somebody from the KGB elevated him to the top position because he would have been so powerful, since he knew so much about everybody as being head of the KGB. So they were always very careful to keep that guy out of the party, top party positions. You had sort of three key elements of power: the army, the KGB, and the party, and they guarded their own power base fairly carefully. And then all of a sudden, you have the head of the KGB being elevated to the top position in the party. Unheard of, unless there were something behind the scenes that enabled that to happen.
Of course, that was
mind control drugs.
That was the last time that happened, though, because when Andropov died, then the acting head of the KGB became the general secretary, a man named Gorbachev.
That's right.
Everybody's forgotten, of course, the Gorbachev who's over here just roaming around and having dinner with all of our political leaders and writing the Earth Charter and planning on this wonderful new order and pushing environmentalism, telling us how we should run our country, and actually we have articles about how he's even supervising the closing of American Army bases. And if you find that difficult to believe, we've got an article out of the San Jose Mercury pointing out that Gorbachev put together a committee to supervise closing American Army bases. Who is Gorbachev? Why, he's the former head of the Soviet KGB. What's wrong with this picture?
It just makes absolute nonsense, you know, how we have embraced Gorbachev, who himself appears like he was almost selected to be embraced. Just a somebody that has a wonderful smile and a grand personality and is able to woo all the people, I guess, as, for example, Margaret Thatcher, and he certainly got along very well with all the people in the White House, to my knowledge, and he picks up all sorts of funding for the Gorbachev Foundation, which is thoroughly ensconced in the Presidio at San Francisco, one of the most beautiful places in the country.
Now, I wonder how Gorbachev got there. I couldn't get any space there. Well, let's go to Steve, who's calling from Michigan on the Internet. Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Oh, wonderful, Doctor. How are y'all doing?
Doing real great. Did you have a question for Dr. Douglas?
Yeah, I was wondering if you could speak to where modern mind control has gone to, where they used to use chemicals, now they use biological or viral agents to affect mind control.
Do you know anything at all about that? I never heard about that. Have you?
It's clear that they've used biological agents in mind control. My own suspicion in that is the way in which a biological agent becomes very useful is as a little production and delivery system.
Yes.
You can, through gene splicing, make various biological organisms so that, or let's say bacteria, so that they can produce, let's say, a small molecular weight protein such as neuropeptides. And you could also cue that organism so that it could produce under certain circumstances. You can then arrange to deliver that to people so that it ends up growing in let's say the human gut, such as E. coli might do very effectively, where you have spliced into that organism a gene that would, in expressing itself, would produce a protein which would have toxic effects in the brain and cause these types of effects. And that was the type of delivery system in the advanced area that they had begun working on back in 1968.
Oh my goodness!
That early, yes. And that's when they were working on the low molecular weight proteins and the synthesis of those proteins, and knew that this was a field for the future. And of course, then in 1972 is when you have the beginning of the immense construction of the genetic engineering laboratories, which ultimately became known under the code word BioPrepArab.
Okay, anything else you want to know, Steve?
Well, just what got me onto this is I saw that the guy that decoded the genome for the West Nile virus at his current project, when I looked a little while ago, was working on the Borna virus, decoding its genome, and being implicated in a lot of mental illness problems that people were having.
I do know one of the things, and that is that many of the people who have the Gulf War illness, this is a multi-faceted entity. It's not one entity, it's many of them entities,
yes.
But many of these people have real memory problems. They just can't concentrate. So obviously, whatever is causing this, and I believe some of this mycoplasma and infectious,
mm-hmm.
really does impact on the brain and its ability to function. And thanks very much for calling, Steve.
Yes, God bless you. Thank you.
And these are frightening things that men have done that can have such disastrous effects on other men. Let's go to Roger calling from Pennsylvania. Hi, Roger. How are we doing?
Yeah, hi, Dennis. Thanks. And my question, how does one distinguish between, say, the chemical adjunct, kind of labor-intensive brainwashing when I'm thinking the relative ease, say, the subtle, relentless propaganda brainwashing, where I think most everybody's susceptible to that, and even like as a point of personal wisdom for myself, knowing full well that does not nevertheless confer any immunity from the technique.
All right, fine. So what's your question is, in essence, you're talking about drugs, you're talking about bacteria, but what about these subtle mind control techniques that are used so readily here in the United States by television and movies? Do you have any comment on that, Dr. Douglas?
Just that they've been obviously very effective. Of course, television, where you just put out one story and put it over and over in different forms, eventually sinks into people's mind and they repeat it as though it was their own. No drugs are needed for that. The other problem, you know, I thought he was getting into a little bit, was the type of thing where you get into brainwashing using physical techniques that are not subtle, that are not covert, but are very overt, that are designed to cause split personalities, but where a person can recall some of the stuff afterwards. I think you have a lot of programs there that have been underway, particularly over in the Soviet Union, strictly as a cover for the real things, which were very, very deeply buried. And thus, when you had so much looking into the psychiatric abuses in the Soviet Union, which really surfaced in the mid to late 1970s, and led to their expulsion from the World Psychiatric Society, I believe about 1988 or so, I forget the precise date. A lot of these, in looking at them, struck me as devising a project that can be exposed and serve as a protective cover to something that is much more serious, such as the types of things we've been talking about, which are covert and act without a person's knowledge, and that's a secret of their success. And when you have a program of that sensitivity, you would always devise another program for use as deliberate exposure to divert attention when it becomes of concern that there might be compromise associated with the real important program.
Okay, thanks very much, Roger. And, of course, we're going to have just 3 more minutes to wrap up the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Dr. Joe Douglas. We've been talking about mind control from the point of view of the Soviet Union, and then, of course, as much as we know about our own programs, that many times actually creating trauma-based dissociative personalities, and we talked a little bit about that, Operation Bluebird, Operation Artichoke, but mostly this evening we've been talking about the material that Dr. Douglas had gotten from Major General Senya, who was with the Czechoslovakian Army. Would you like to sort of wrap up your thoughts for the evening, Joe?
Well, you know, Stan, working on this various problems over the past, 35 years or so, this area of mind control and what the Soviets have accomplished there is, to my way of thinking, the most important thing I've ever come across. And it's doubly important because of the efforts by our own government to suppress any knowledge that these things exist or are taking place. And so I just encourage people to give your call and take a look at the Project Bluebird or Betrayed or any of these other books that really talk about MK Ultra, and to start becoming familiar with the realities of what was actually accomplished and what can be done today.
And, of course, I think it's vitally important that people understand that there has been an organized effort to learn how to control our reality, how to manipulate our emotions, how to get people to do what you want them to. And I think we saw this beautifully example of this in California here in the last week, when 2 weeks ago, 35% of the people supported this massive borrowing by the state, and then with a massive propaganda campaign, it ended up 2/3 of the people supported the borrowing of the bond process. Why? Because day after day after day after day, you heard this story over again on television. And television has a tremendous impact. I know my daughter works in a program trying to teach people about the dangers and the moral objection to abortion. And after a 6-month television campaign in the South where she works, they were able to shift the attitude of 9% of the population. well, if it had as much money as Arnold had here in California to bring the people around, they could have got two-thirds of the people on their side as well. But this is frightening. You can control what the majority of the American people think. Dr. Douglas, any parting thoughts?
You know, with that in mind, Dr. Stan, I remember watching an interview with some people as they left the polls in about 1996, as I recall. And it really struck me interesting because the words coming out of their mouths were not the way people talk. They were really parroting what they heard on television and using those words to describe their thoughts.
Well, thanks very much for being with us, Dr. Joe Douglas. And, of course, let me just remind our listeners, Dr. Douglas has written a wonderful book. It's called Betrayed. And the first part of this, of course, deals with the mind control process. And then, of course, it goes into the background of the American soldiers. They were abandoned in the First World War, the Second World War, Korea, and Vietnam. And so if you'd like to know more about the book, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, the Operation Bluebird, written by a psychiatrist who has had to work with the people who were actually treated by the CIA to create multiple personalities. We have the MK Ultra files. We have the reports, official government reports, which you're not going to find at your local library because these have been actively suppressed. We have, of course, the excellent book, The Medusa File by Craig Roberts, that touches on this and so many other issues. We have the report, we call it the Rockefeller Report, put out by the Veterans Administration, going into all the macabre experiments that have been done on Americans through the years. Rather frightening to think these things are done, and Rush Limbaugh just never gets around to telling us. Well, Dr. Douglas, thank you so much for being with us. God bless you. It's appreciated being on with us tonight.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stan. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
And, of course, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you'd like, of course, to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, it's as easy as picking up your telephone and calling us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Of course, we hope that many of you will want to do that. If you'd like to get a free copy of our latest newsletter, and that really deals with what really happened on the morning of September 11th and the what led up to that. And what did the government really know? What were they really thinking? Not what they tell us. What were they really thinking about the likelihood of a terrorist attack on American soil designed to kill Americans? Well, you'll want to get our February newsletter. And if you give us a call of 1-800-544-8927, that's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll be glad to send you a copy, free copy of our February newsletter. And, of course, you can go off to our website at www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs there directly or through links 5 hours a day. First hour in the morning on AmericanNewsNet.com, the American Freedom Network. The second program, 2 hours on Genesis at GCNLive.com. And then, of course, our evening program on RadioLiberty.com. 4 hours a day on shortwave, and your job, your assignment, is to tell other people about our program, encourage them to listen if they need a shortwave. Of course, we do carry them through Radio Liberty. And, of course, we hope that many of you will go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, pull down our old newsletters, and copy those, study them, get the information. If you need any of the documentation, we'd be glad to provide that for you. We do carry some fascinating videos, Diapracs in the Church, the story of the church growth movement that is sweeping America today, and how it's designed to change both the music and the message of the church. Indeed, it's designed to lead a great apostasy away from the true gospel. And then, of course, the video Megiddo, the March to Armageddon, the video The Brotherhood of Darkness, 9/11, contrived. That's 9/11 contrived, Iraq, the untold story, the story of all the wars of the last century, which were all contrived. None of them were fought for the reasons that our boys went overseas to bleed and fight and suffer and die, thinking that they were fighting in the war to end all wars, the war to make the world safe for democracy. That was the slogan in the First World War, but it was really all about creating a new world order and a new world religion. And that's all covered in my book, or the video, The Brotherhood of Darkness. This is the time we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening, at the same time, we'll be with you once again. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, well, you can call us, of course. We welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because, of course, we have with us a very special guest, a fellow talk show host from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. His name is John Loeffler. Hi, John. How are you doing tonight?
Hi, how do I get talked into doing these shows?
Well, I appreciate you doing that. After all, you know, you get the opportunity to talk to our top-notch stations here in the East Coast, in Chicago, and in Flint, Michigan, and Albany, and Utica, and Fort Wayne, Indiana, across the nation on shortwave, and across the nation on Internet, and we don't even charge you to be a guest.
Are they all part of the United States, too?
Well, anyway, we talked a little earlier about what we were going to cover this evening, and John commented on, of course, the issue of same-sex marriage, and how, you know, they just love, of course, to have a picture of the happy couple there together, and then they always have them kiss at the end, and they do that because they know it's going to upset the heterosexuals in this country, and it's a beautiful example of how you use something as a diversion to take our attention away from really important issues, and they keep hammering away and hammering away and hammering away at this, whereas the important issues that are going to affect our lives are seldom, if ever, mentioned. The Martha Stewart story, the Scott Peterson story, the Toby Bryant story, all of these important, life-threatening, life-shaking events. But, you know, the world is changing. And, of course, the average American doesn't really understand that the globalization process is shipping our jobs and our industries overseas, destroying the value of our currency, will eventually lead to the impoverishment of the American people, and America will become like every other third world country, without an industrial base. And these things are happening not by accident, by intent, but while our attention is focused on those people, they're just kissing again. Look at them kissing up there on the television screen. And we, of course, it's like the old sleight of hand expert. When he wants, of course, to put something over on you, you're watching one hand while the other one's really doing the business. So, John, why don't you pick up the story from there?
Well, in martial arts, we call that a feint, F-E-I-N-T. In other words, you you play like you're doing one thing, so the person's attention gets distracted over there. And we've had a whole chain of distractions for like 15 years, for as long as I've been doing talk radio, from things that are unimportant. The other interesting thing is that, actually, we were joking this afternoon, and I said, well, if they want to get married, let them, then they can have part of the marriage penalty like the rest of us, you know, so on the income tax, why not?
Oh, that's right. Do they still penalize that people get married?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's supposed to be phased out, like we're phasing out the death tax and all this other sort of stuff, but, you know, I mean, my gosh, there's so much we can talk about. We just better get a move on here. I'm trying to think of which way we should go with this. In reality, basically, that whole battle was lost 40 years ago. That's what I'm always amazed at, is that, you know, you see all the religious groups come rushing in and there's a big brouhaha and everything, but as the cultural shift began, as we rejected the previous values, as we adopted values, clarification and relativism in the schools, and we removed God and did all of those things, that's where the battle was lost, and everybody sort of watched it go on through. This is all what I call downstream issues. And in reality, the church doesn't really have a leg to stand on in opposing homosexual marriage, simply because of the fact that they went along with the secularization of the culture. And if the secularization of the culture is there, you know, you have people that say, well, we're citizens too, we have a right to do this, and frankly, they're right.
Hold on just a moment, we'll be right back. Okay, Dr. Stan here, and of course our guest is John Loeffler, and he's saying that the church has stood by while our culture was secularized, and of course, you know, the churches which should have taken their kids, every Christian child, out of the government school, the ministers didn't have the courage to speak out against that, and so that we raised a whole generation of our children in government schools with socialist ideas, but even more than that, they began to question that God created the heavens and the earth. Oh, no, evolution. Science has disproven that. And, of course, they come out of school, so many of them, really believing that the government can solve our problems rather than the original American concept that the government was our problem. So pick up the story from there, John.
Well, basically, that's where the battle was lost. There were two things that basically that happened. If you go as far back as the 30s, remember the humanist educators such as John Dewey and others, said that if we could have the kids for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and by the way, they're pushing for even longer hours now, that it didn't make any difference what the parents taught them in the evening and what the Sunday school teachers taught them on Sunday, that sooner or later the culture could be transformed. And believe it or not, right now, even inside government education, they're still talking about the restructuring of society. They intend to restructure it. And their dream is sort of a socialist, I guess, utopia, where everybody, there's a place for everybody and everybody in his place, and most people will be given enough education to do their job, but that's about it, and you'll have a group of elitists at the top. Now, somebody, I'm sure, thinking, listening to this, could say, oh, well, geez, he's making this up. Well, I didn't make it up. You can find it by just browsing through a lot of the educational literature going back over the decades. So, about in the 1960s, we started making some radical changes in education. We psychologized it after the education of Maslow and Rogers, and at about the same time, within plus or minus 5 years, we managed to boot prayer out of the school. And then that completely secularized it. Now, at that stage of the game, that's right about where the church needed to have jumped in and said, well, excuse me, now that religion is no longer in the schools, although it really was the Christian religion that was no longer there, other religions were well represented in various aspects, but now that religion is no longer in the school, are you going to be teaching values, attitudes, and beliefs? And the answer was yes, because the school continued to do that. Then the Christian pastors and parents should have said, well, whose bad attitudes, values, and beliefs are you going to teach? That was the point where the objection should be made. But they didn't do that, and so what happened is the whole new set of values had to be proposed, and if you go back and read some of the teachers' journals and things like that back in that time, what the educrats were saying is we really had to separate the children from the value systems of their parents.
Hold that thought for just a minute as our stations join us here and come right back on. All right, and with us is John Loeffler, and John, of course, is pointing out that the church failed, the ministers failed, organized religion failed, to challenge what took place in 1962 as they took God and prayer out of our schools, and say if you're going to teach values and in our schools, whose values are you going to teach? Because they always have to be somebody's values. They're either Christian values or Judeo-Christian values, or they're the values of the secular humanist that, of course, see nothing really very special about life, sees euthanasia perfectly acceptable, wants socialism, wants world government, and certainly sees nothing wrong with indiscriminate sex or abortion. So, you know, and those were the values that were taught in our schools.
Yeah, I mean, and so basically that's where the stage was set, and it was strictly a matter of time. Once the dam had been blown, it was just a matter of time before the water would rush down the valley. So it's really sort of, I guess the word isn't hypocritical, but ironic that all of a sudden when you finally have this whole issue of same-sex marriage that they should be jumping up and down and yelling and screaming. They go, you forfeited that right 40 years ago. You voluntarily laid it down, so shut up. You have nothing to say in this whole thing, because these people can legitimately come in now and say, oh, well, yeah, we're citizens too, and they are, and we pay taxes, and they do. Why can't they have it their way? Who is to say that their way isn't any better than ours? Because, you see, we bought into the system of values clarification, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just arguing from a point of being logically consistent. And typically what has happened during all of these battles that have come along has been the church always arrives out of breath, little dazed, wondering what's going on, and invariably always dealing with what I call surface or downstream issues rather than with core issues. And we're right now, as you mentioned starting out on the show, Dr. Stan, we're fighting other battles of critical core issues in the culture, and only small groups of the church even seem aware of the fact that there's a battle for its life going on right now, that this will have profound implications in how the church lives out its existence over the next 10 or 20 years in the West, because it will put horrible demands on us. Remember, the new system is not going to leave the church alone. It is going to try to impose its attitudes, values, and beliefs on the church, whether the church likes it or not. Let me give you an example. Look at the whole flap over Mel Gibson's Passion. When you strip away all the nonsense about anti-Semitism, there's always what I call a surface issue. Some issue that is used to transport this whole thing before the public mind. All right. When you strip it all away, what was the whole fracas all about? The whole fracas was all about the fact that Mel Gibson violated the cardinal rule of this whole tolerance and diversity relative values crowd, and that is, thou shalt not parade thy religious values before anybody else. You will not do anything to challenge the structure. What these people are apoplectic about is that not only did he parade it before everybody else, meaning he made a public movie that was then seen in, you know, it's what's been listed in 4,000 theaters in this country, but not only that, but huge quantities of people are going to see it. Now, this is actually a plus, because what it means is the secularists have really failed to completely indoctrinate Western culture in their belief system, because here are millions of people who are rejecting that. The tragedy is that while all this crowd will go and see the movie, very few of them will stand up where it's counted.
Well, I thought the movie must be very good. I haven't had a chance to see it yet, but I read a critique in the New York Times where they had a rabbi and a couple of ministers and a Greek Orthodox priest, and they were just also bored with it. They thought it wasn't worthwhile going to see. Now, I've talked to enough people who've seen this film. Apparently it's a powerful, powerful movie, one of those things that you will never forget. And, you know, when I see that sort of an article in the New York Times, and knowing where the New York Times is coming from, they're coming from the enemy of everything worthwhile and that you and I would believe in, I figure this has got to be a great movie if they put a whole article in there trying to demean the movie and saying it's boring. I know it must be a truly gripping film.
They didn't put just an article in there trying to do the film. The New York scandal, by the way, is facing another major scandal very shortly here that has not yet come to light. And maybe we can just touch on it. But having said that, they also ran an op-ed piece saying, well, this whole thing could really wreck Mel Gibson's career. And I really had to giggle when I read it, because it was like the day or so before the thing opened. And as it began to open, of course, within the first two or three days of showing, the movie made back its cost. And headed for the sky, it'll probably be the record box office movie of this year. These were nothing but sour grapes pieces designed to turn, you know, we remember you and I talk a lot about how there are predetermined outcomes that people are trying to steer you towards. That's what this was all about. It had nothing to do with it. It was not a boring movie. Everybody I have talked to, you know, if it was such a boring movie, what was Abraham Foxman from the Anti-Defamation League jumping up and down about, for Pete's sake? You see, they're not even consistent in the way they deal. But that is something you need to understand about the new secularism. Because of the fact that there is a belief in no absolute values, therefore everything is basically utilitarian in its function.
You know, I was just going to say, this morning I was sitting down skimming through Time, U.S. News, and World Report, and Newsweek articles on The Passion. And, of course, they were all hitting The Passion, how terrible it was. But in Time magazine, they were talking about, you know, just the total confusion, and even so many Christians are confused about the significance of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. And it said, of course, Jesus was not a Christian. Jesus was a Jew. And I'm reading this, Jesus wasn't a Christian, Jesus was a Jew. Well, talk about sophistry. I mean, what in heaven's name are they saying?
Right.
I mean, what this is sort of doing is sort of using a phrase like this, you know, to just try to discredit the film. But what they're doing is playing games with your mind. Of course, there wasn't any Christian religion at the time, but Jesus was the very center of Christianity. And yet he wasn't a Christian. Come on now. The fact that they would put that in Time magazine along with the rest of the things to deprecate the film. But it's not simply the New York Times and Time magazine and U.S. News and Newsweek. The entire left-wing spectrum, the entire media of America has been hitting this film, which I think reflects the fact that the media thinks one way, and I think the American people think the other. I think it's amazing that with all the propaganda that they're able to put out through the controlled media, there's still an awful lot of people who can think independently on their own. I think that's a great sign that shows there's still an awful lot of great people here in America. America can still be saved if we can reach them with the truth.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that because you write about that. And number one, these people have shown their colors. If one thing that has happened here is they have tipped their hand clearly in that they have shown their colors. First of all, they're very bigoted. All right, if Andy Rooney's rants and raves weren't the mark of a bigot, I don't know what is. But number two, rather than being the neutral people that they always claim to be, you know, the honest reporters of news, they have shown themselves to be hideously, hideously biased towards a radical leftist, secular agenda and virulently angry about any other worldview that would dare come in and compete for it. To a certain degree, to be honest with you, especially wait till this next scandal erupts at the New York Times, they're beginning to lose the grip. They're bothered by, you know, you hear a lot of complaints sometimes about Fox News. But it isn't just Fox News. Fox News is sort of a neutral thing. There are all sorts of alternative slides of information that have come out there, and they haven't been able to dam up the information flow, which I think is more than forever. But what has really been interesting about the whole thing, especially in the Andy Rooney thing on CBS, has been the fact that while they're always preaching tolerance and diversity, there was so much venom spilling all over the place, they've almost endangered their ability to ever claim themselves to be tolerant or diverse again. Ain't nobody buying it. This follows an attack, by the way, if you remember a couple of months ago, by CBS on homeschool. The new attack on homeschoolers is to make homeschooling, to link it in the public mind with child abuse. That's the new effort that's going on out there. Maybe we could skip to the next topic here, because the war on homeschool is just starting to heat up. As we, if you remember, we started, when homeschool started out, it was sort of a renegade thing 20 years ago. And remember, the schooling of the government schools and the schooling of homeschoolers are driven by radically different worldviews, radically different philosophical assumptions. So at first, the educrats said, well, you know, you just can't get as good an education at home because mothers aren't qualified to teach, because they don't have all sorts of degree letters after their name, et cetera, et cetera, blah, 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 and they just can't get as good a quality of education. Well, they pretty soon shot that one down because they were soaring above the government school kids, something like 30 average points on standardized testing. and they began taking the prizes in all the national competitions. Then you know what we heard? We heard from the educrats, well, that's not fair, because they get a better education because they get more one-on-one time than the kids in the public school did. So they actually reversed their position and once again pulled out that what I call that utilitarian argument. You see, this crowd is not interested, Dr. Stan, in any kind of logical consistency. They will pull out of their hat what is ever required to prove a point at any given point. So then they went to the next argument. They said, well, the kids just can't be socialized. Now, you really have to look at sort of the socialization. You can't, you know, learn how to put condoms on bananas. You can't be tempted to use drugs. You can't be beat up, shot, killed, or in other ways, suffer from massive peer pressure. But most of the homeschooling parents figured, you know, I bet our kids can get along without that socialization for a while. And in reality, you know, the stratification of children into layers was another one of these John Dewey-eyed ideas for the purpose of controlling the minds of the children. Because rather than learning in an even stream from adults on down through layered groups of people above them, they began to interact largely only with people in their own age group. So you had the blind leading the blind. And that is why today, for example, if you talk to a homeschooler, a teenage homeschooler in high school, you will find them to be very eloquent in the way they express themselves, and they can interact with adults. I challenge you to get high schoolers to do that.
Hold on. We'll be right with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course our guest is John Loeffler of Steel on Steel. But right now we have Rose hanging patiently on the line from New York. Hi, Rose. Did you have a question or comment?
I have a comment. I want to go back to the discussion about the film. I don't think that all the to-do was to keep people away, but actually to draw them to it. And I would ask every Christian to pray before the Lord to see if they should see that film. We have the source of vain imagination of a man who glorifies violence to the human body. The characters, the man who wrote the music, he wrote the music for Bruce Almighty, a very blasphemous theme. I think if you look into the film, you find the source or the fountain is not one that Christians should be going to. If they want to know more about the cross of Christ, they should go to their scripture and to the Lord whose cross it was. And what I am disturbed about is I hear all these leaders come out and say how wonderful the film is and how exactly like scripture it is. And it's far from the truth.
Have you seen the film, Rose?
I've read people's accounts. I heard Mel Gibson.
Yes. The answer is no.
Excuse me?
The answer is no.
No what?
You haven't seen the film.
No, I've taken it from their own words.
Okay, fine.
Gibson's,
okay,
bro. And people who have seen it, and let's go to scripture. Where do we go?
I don't want to go into a long dissertation, but you vote against people seeing the film.
Yes, and I would ask them just to bring it to the Lord.
That's right. Where
we belong to find out.
All right, okay, fine.
Thank you so much, Rose. I'm trying to find some substance. I've read a lot of these arguments, but I don't find a lot of substance for seeing or not seeing a film. And regardless of the Christian controversy in this thing, it's still the secular side decided to line up against the church on this issue. You know, the whole controversy sort of bothers me in terms of the whole thing. I don't know. Maybe that's something to deal with. Maybe you want to have people call in. I'd love to go around on it.
Well, I think that before I commented on the film, I'd like to see the film myself, and I'm going to go see it. And I'm not going to... I've heard all of these arguments. Mel Gibson is a Catholic. Oh, terrible. He's a Catholic. Not only that, but he read the writings of some woman who lived in 1800 who had the stigmata. And you know what that means.
And, and Catherine Emmerich.
Right. And so I think that the issue is, what does this film say? What will its impact be? I want to see the film before I make a decision one way or the other. I really hope that it does more good than harm. I'd rather think that it will, but we'll wait and see. We've got Tony calling in from SoCal. Hi, Tony. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. I like listening to two of my favorite guys at the same time.
Okay, fine. Well, you can't hear at the same time. John does talk over me, so I have a hard time getting word in as well. Go ahead, Tony.
I love both you guys. But I did see the movie.
What did you think of it?
Well, let me warn anyone who goes to see it, take a few Kleenex with you. because it's rather difficult to watch every scene and watch the entire movie without getting emotional, to say the least. Now, I've never been one much to cry in my life. In fact, my father, my earthly father, told me that when I was a baby, I never cried. And there were reasons for it, which I won't go into. And I think in my whole entire life, the only time I've ever cried was when my earthly father died, and when I saw this movie.
Well, what you're saying, it's a powerful movie.
It's a very powerful movie. I don't see anything in it that's not scriptural. There were a few scenes, and I thought they were very powerful, especially before Jesus was arrested, when he was sweating great drops of blood, and the devil was there, and he was trying to almost like tempt him away from the cross. Now, that's not in the Bible, I know that. But it was very realistic, and it wasn't in the scriptures, but I really feel that it was something that was very apropos.
You know, one of the things, from my point of view, Tony, is that we don't address the fact that there really is this spiritual battle. The devil is here. He's working in America. He's working within our churches. He's working within our educational system, within our government today. And I see nothing wrong at all with putting him into that, into the context of that movie, because I'm sure, and I saw those clips where the devil was saying, don't do this. Don't do this because you can't do this. You can't bear the sins of all of mankind. It's impossible. No man can.
Well, the Apostle Paul said that Jesus became sin.
Amen.
Because he became sin for us. And then in Isaiah 53, you know, he took upon himself our sins, our iniquities. And by his stripes we were healed. And he became sin, Paul said. I mean, and in Hebrews chapter 10, it says he was in the order of the line of Melchizedek. He offered the sacrifice once and for all to replace all of the previous animal sacrifices.
Okay,
that they wouldn't ever have to be done again.
What do you think, John?
About which now?
What about what Tony's saying?
Well, I know everybody who's seen the movie, I've been waiting to see it. I deliberately waited a couple of weeks. Everybody who's seen the movie said it was pretty heavy. A friend of mine said he had a hard time sleeping that night. I don't have any problem. I would assume, you know, if you understand that what I think that would portray is the fact that I think Jesus carried that load of Satan at every point, all the way through there. Satan would have been present seeing this whole thing through to its conclusion. Although the yay-nay decision was really in the Garden of Gethsemane. At that point, Jesus could have still called it off. Once the gears of the system started moving, that was pretty much it as far as a go, no-go decision on his part. And that's why I think the temptation was so rough there.
Okay. Thanks very much, Tony.
Well, can I just say one other thing?
Sure you can.
And the reason why I think there's all the commotion and why the liberal atheist, ACLU crowd and all the rest of the left-wing jargon are all apoplectic about the whole thing, is because, and it just dawned on me a couple of days ago, is that the Bible says that the preaching of the cross is foolishness to them that perish. And Mel Gibson in this movie, in my opinion, it was a Da Vinci and a Michelangelo combined preaching the cross. And I think that was the simple message of this movie, if there is such a thing, is that it preached the cross, and that the whole gospel message is that Christ suffered, that he endured these things, that he went through them things, all of these things. He set his face to the cross, knowing that that was the only way that the debt of sin could be paid. That was the only way that Hades and Sheol and hell could be swallowed up, that the sting of death could be destroyed. And that he accomplished those things through the cross, through his sufferings. And the Bible says that is, if even an angel of light appear unto you and preach any other message than Christ crucified, let him be anathema or accursed. And this movie preached the gospel of the cross in a way that I believe that all should know how much our Savior and how much he endured in his love for the individual.
Okay, God bless you. Thanks so much, Tom.
And if you go, take some Kleenex.
All right, bye-bye. Well, we have one vote on one side and one vote on the other.
You know the most amazing thing is, I think the one thing everybody forgets that Paul talks about is what I call freedom under grace. That we really have the freedom to make these judgment calls. But, you know, I would like to hear, I'd almost like to hear more on the negative side, because the arguments don't sort of hold together. And
oh my goodness, we've got a number of listeners who really are very much against the film.
Have written me
multiple page emails telling me why I shouldn't go see the film, and one of them has even gone to see the film and then wants to give me all the reasons why we shouldn't go to see it. Well, we won't solve the problem tonight, and of course I'm going to see the film one way or the other. I don't think this will hurt my eternal salvation. But anyway, we'll be back here in just a moment with our special friend and special guest, John Leffler. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, John Leffler. John, you want to pick up the story from there?
Well, as far as which, what are we talking
about? Well, no,
we were talking about
homeschooling, and of course, then we of course got taken back to the Mel Gibson film. So, you want to go on with your homeschooling, because I agree with you totally. You can tell when a child has been homeschooled, they're entirely different. The look in their eyes, the way they shake your hand, really what we're doing to our children in school, I think it's criminal.
Well, you know, when we talked about the secular educators that started back in the 30s, and then we switched into psychologizing them in the 60s. By the end of the 80s, as we went into the Governor's Conference on Education in 89, there was a very firm plan afoot to convert schools from places where learning took place to job force training centers. That's all we were going to do. And it's not only what values the kids have been taught while they're in school, it is the process that they have been taught to think, how they think. They have been raised in a dialectic pattern of thought, which I maintain is nothing short of diabolical. It came out of the minds of Marx and Hegel and this crowd, and was later refined by Stalin and Lenin and others. And this dialectical process of thought is what accounts for the glassy look you get a lot of times on the eyes of youth, or the confused look is maybe better. In other words, there's no direction in their minds and their hearts. And it's because it's not only what they've been taught, it's also the fact that rather than being given a didactic process, which is a biblical process for organizing into categories, etc., they're thinking in this dialectic of relative values. And it's like a mental narcotic. It prevents you from seeing something and analyzing it, because it decrees that there are no categories into which to put things and how to organize it. So that's why, you know, you have this. And I've watched this over and over again. I just had a request from a homeschool group in New Zealand to reprint an article I did on this whole thing. That I will, when I talk to teenagers, I work on them to try to see what's going on. And most of the time, you know, if I walk up to them, it's like, "Hi, Ryan, how you doing?" "What's going on?" "Oh, nothing." Now, they'll turn right around and run off with their friends, so they're very busy doing nothing. I'm not sure what that nothing is they're doing, but they're very busy, and they obviously can't discuss it with me. When you talk to a homeschooler, they're talking about politics, they're talking about things going on, they've got ideas for their lives. As a matter of fact, my youngest son, has been so brash about his political beliefs and stuff, I've had to start teaching him tact. You know, and like, okay, wait a minute, there's a time and a place, and a way that you hit this thing on the head. You just can't sort of blurt it out all over the place. But the first time this ever came true to me is back in...
Hold that thought for just a moment when our other stations join us right now. Okay, our guest this evening, John Leffler, and he's talking about homeschooling and, of course, the difference in the homeschooled child from the government-schooled child. And the homeschooled child is interested in all sorts of things and could carry on an intelligent conversation, and so often the government-schooled child, you know, really has a hard time applying himself and carrying on a really intelligent conversation. Now, this is a general rule. This is not every single one of them. But what they've done is they've changed their values to values clarification. They've changed their worldview. There are no absolutes. There is no God. You can't depend upon anything. You don't like your government. You know, and they've just stolen from these children a belief in anything, a divine belief in anything that's permanent, the greatness of America. And these young people have nothing to believe in. It's almost like this old adage, you know, life is simply a matter of quiet desperation. You know, no good deed will ever go unpunished. And what do they have ready to look forward to? What do they believe in other than materialism and a desire to get a big, fast car and a house and a good-looking girl? You have to have something more than that. These ideas of courage and virtue and integrity that once were instilled in our young people are no longer instilled in them.
Well, not only that, you know, one of the interesting things that you talked about, you mentioned integrity and courage and things like that. The consensus process, the dialectic process, operates on how you feel. And we do have emotions. We're sentient creatures. But the problem with operating on how you feel is sometimes doing the right thing will make you feel perfectly awful. Or sometimes holding and standing your ground when standing your ground is called for may not feel very good because there's a lot of emotional pressure from peers or from authorities around you. And that's why this method of thinking is horrible. It's why people aren't going to hold marriages together, why they're not going to make it through life, why they're not reliable business partners, et cetera, et cetera. Because they're all operating on feeling, and when you operate on feeling, you ultimately come down to what's best for me perceived in the short run, which isn't necessarily best for you overall or in the long run. So that's it. But the war on homeschooling is going to rev up here again. We see it. And it's going to hit on a number of fronts because the elite, once again, are just sputtering mad that a whole bunch of people. Now we have more homeschool kids in the country than are all the students in the state of New Jersey. And they've got to force them back into this system. So the demonization has begun. It's very subtle, but you see it popping up in newspaper articles, and CBS did a thing associating homeschool with child abuse. And the theory, and so what they'll do is they'll go out and find what I call a token case and hold this up and say, why, look at this, this is horrible. And you know, these homeschoolers are unregulated, and if we would just regulate them, yada yada, things would be better. Now, in the more liberal states, the more regulation occurs. But nevertheless, that's the direction it's going to go. The next step will be to deal with them on what's called standardized testing. The argument will be, well, the public school kids have to do standardized testing. Why shouldn't the homeschool? And at face value, that sounds good. And if the tests were involving strictly, say, for example, mathematics and historical questions and things of that nature, you could do that. But what most people don't know, especially the public who haven't been around schools in years, is that what tests such as the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the NAEP, about 50% of the questions on there are not asking academic questions, but are determined to find out what the students' fixed attitude, values, and beliefs are. And because homeschoolers and public schoolers teach from different, totally different philosophical worldviews and assumptions and bases, it will be very difficult for homeschoolers to, quote, pass, end quote, tests such as the NAEP and others. Because in order to pass, you're going to have to teach to the test. The next stage that you'll see some opposition is going to be in the area of accreditation moving into colleges. Now, it's interesting that a lot of colleges are seeking homeschoolers because, lo and behold, they're discovering that unlike the government school children, they don't have to be remediated when they go to college. You know, most of the beginning level classes, a lot of them, are remediatory in nature. Because why? Because the skills that they were supposed to have gotten in grade school, they didn't get because the system is a radical failure. However, on the flip side of that, the accreditation and whether or not they'll let you in without a GED is becoming an issue. To give you an example, 3 years ago, actually it's 4 years now, 2 years ago, my daughter was moving up from the junior college here to, she had applied to a number of colleges to continue working towards a Bachelor of Science degree. She had just gotten an Associate of Science degree, but the state college here wanted her to go and get a GED because they didn't recognize the high school diploma from an accredited institution that we had worked through as a satellite school. Now, this is ludicrous, Dr. Stan. She had just gotten an Associate of Science degree from a college. She was on the National Dean's List for a straight A average, but you see, you have a politically correct college, and they're going to play this game. They're not looking at the welfare of the student. They're not looking at whether or not they've done well or poorly. You're looking at one thing. Are you playing the dialectical game according to the rules? It's the very same thing that Mel Gibson did. You see, he refused to play the dialectical game, and they went apoplectic on him. And that's what's happening. The last thing will be, if the plans ever get implemented, although they're faltering now, believe it or not, there's actually opposition growing even from the liberal side of the equation, especially from teachers who are getting tired of implementing some of the things in No Child Left Behind. But if it ever comes through, it will be the whole concept of job referrals, in that you're going to have to play this consensus game. And I know you've probably had Bob Klink, and I don't know if you've ever had Dean Gocher or Steve Goss on to talk about it.
Right.
But if you're going into the job market now, especially in big corporations, everybody's got to play this dialectical game of training and tolerance and diversity and glop that may go against your worldview and your own particular values and beliefs. So once again, we have the system claiming to be tolerant and diverse. Well, in reality, it's shoving a very narrow set of values down the throats of a lot of people who just don't want it. So those are going to be the wars against homeschools, because the system doesn't work unless everybody's in it. That's one thing that all the dialectical people know. And you also have to have feedback loops in order to make it work. So if you cut off the feedback loops by no testing, and everybody is not in the system isn't going to work very well. So there inevitably will have to be some kind of continuing war on homeschool. So that's one of the trends you can look forward in the future.
All right. Well, we've got Roger hanging on very, very patiently from Pennsylvania. Hi, Roger. How are you doing?
Yeah, thanks, gentlemen. We were just talking about on that NAEP test. I think it was both in Chalcedon Report, Rush Dooney's publication, and I believe also the Christian Philosophy of Education, the Gordon Clark book, predicted that you would probably have to teach your children to lie to the test, that is, to give the expected answer rather than the least wrong answer.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I've been talking with Dean Gocher about that very thing, about will it be and you're right about that. In other words, we've had this issue come up in our kids' college education, and the answer is, well, you don't give the answer that's expected. That doesn't mean that's what you believe. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, the reason I really called, I wanted to take back to that cheery topic with Mel Gibson, because it's all too rare that we're able to so thoroughly gloat and stick a thumb in the eye of this mass media madness. Their self-buffoonification has rarely been so complete. But before I take you back to that cheerier topic, I would just please beg all the listeners to pray for the family of and all those connected with that noble warrior Marlon Maddox, who I had just heard just checked out this morning.
Oh, that's such a shame. Well, of course, Marlon was been one of the great champions of the conservative movement for many years.
And I would also please beg everyone to play that the show as well, recovers some of the incisive edge which it's lost, perhaps because of Marlon's poor health these last few years. And back to the thing with Mel, I heard Aaron Zellman today, rapper,
yeah.
Daniel Lapin has come out, and a few select others. And Aaron Zellman of Jews for Protection of Firearms Ownership, I guess his most charitable read of Abe Foxman and the ADL is that with their awful $60 million budget, that he reckons it as a fundraising ploy.
Well, I think that probably Abe Foxman did more to popularize this film and get people wanting to go to see it than anybody else. And, of course, some people have said maybe he was really sort of a stealth agent for Mel Gibson. I don't believe that at all. But he couldn't have done more good if he'd been working for Mel. God bless. Thanks very much. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Of course, that was Roger calling from Pennsylvania. Sometimes controversy can really raise the issue. I think that Mel has handled this very well. I've heard him interviewed, you know, and of course I remember hearing him being asked, you know, well, did the Jews crucify Christ? And he commented, no, I crucified him. And apparently the only place you saw Mel Gibson's at all in the film was his hand that was driving the nail. I don't know if you'd heard that story.
Yes.
I think that was very touching. Anyway, we'll get, let's not get onto that. I get a little emotional when I think of this film because I think it's a powerful, powerful film. I hate to see it being abashed, not so much by the left as I would expect, but by the Christian element, simply because Mel is a Catholic. And I think that, probably there are going to be a lot of Catholics in heaven, and I think that some of the Protestants who are sure they're going to be there may very well hear those horrible words, you know, I never knew you. And I think that the new movement that we're seeing in the Protestant church, it's called the Church Growth Movement, which is doing exactly what you are describing, this dialectic approach. The dialectic approach is now in the Protestant church. This is an integral part of the corporate management techniques that make up the Church Growth Movement. Have you gotten into that at all?
Yeah, we have. I mean, basically, it's the Church Growth programs, as you well know, have just adopted the programs of Peter Drucker, who was a business management guru. It's the very same thing as Total Quality Management. Rick Warren did not think this stuff up. He simply candy-coated it over. And as we point back, if we take the train back of thought, we can go back to the Tavistock Institute, all the way back to the Institute for Marxist Research, which became the Institute for Social Research, which finally opened shop in the 30s at the teachers' colleges here in this country and began the radical transformation of education into the teachers' colleges. So the biggest problem is it's a mental narcotic. I guess my bottom line, I have two big comments on the bottom line of using this stuff in the church. Number one, why are we using a Marxist doctrine inside a Christian church? Number two, the church growth movement results in an increase of warm bodies in the church, warm bodies who pay money. It does not result in an increase of believers in the church because it's very difficult. It becomes more and more difficult in these churches to get a clear enunciation of the gospel and to get a clear enunciation of what this all means. It works on the exact opposite principle of what the gospel relies on. But the problem is, once again, because of its dialectical nature, it's like a mental narcotic. It will put even a sound person to sleep in terms of keeping their guard up. And that's why it's so diabolically demonic, because of its nature.
Well, I think, of course, the whole thing is a plan. And first of all, you want, of course, get the people into the church and have them get a lot of friends so they identify with the church. And as they point out, if you have a lot of friends in the church, you're not going to leave. And, of course, the inference is you're not going to leave no matter what we do to you. And then, of course, they have a program to get rid of anybody who doesn't want to go along with this, to make their life miserable and to actually drive them out of the church. I mean, this is hardly a Christian thing to do. But I believe that the music has a profound impact on the hearts and minds and the very souls of people. And we've done some fascinating interviews recently with a Dr. Carson Holloway. Have you had him on your program, John?
No, I haven't.
He wrote a book called All Shook Up by Spence Publishing, an excellent interview. He goes into the background of what Aristotle and Plato wrote about music and how it can impact on the soul. It can impact on society, and they recognized that, you know, 2,350 years ago, something around there. And they, of course, felt that there was good music that relied upon good rhythm and good harmony, and of course this would have a beneficial impact. There was other music that would inflame the passions and was totally destructive to society. And that's the sort of music that 2,000 years later we are bringing into the Christian church, this loud, raucous, loud beat, discordant music with the drums and the you know, and the electric guitars, and you know, that makes you, it inflames the passions. Why are we bringing this into the church? This is not the sort of music you'd expect to hear when you get to heaven. And yet, of course, this is what they're using in the churches, because it has an impact on the heart and minds and souls of the people and prepares them for the small groups where they'll get their dialectic instruction. As we move them away from didactic teaching into dialectic teaching, and into the changing their attitude so they can't think clearly. And you're using these small group approaches on people who don't have any mental problems, and yet that's exactly what Rogers and Maslow used on people who did have emotional problems, and of course they created real problems.
I take it you're not into Iron Butterfly, huh?
Well, I really think that...
Are you the later group?
People have to really understand what's going on today. And, of course, the disastrous effect this is going to happen. We're told that by Rick Warren that this movement that he is heading is going to transform society. And all we have to do is look at society today and say, well, Rick Warren's been around with us for a fair length of time. Is society getting better or getting worse? And just turn on your television and see the pictures of the homosexuals smooching there on the screen, and is society getting better or worse?
Yeah, but let me point something out. Francis Schaeffer wrote a number of very important books prior to his death in the 1980s. One of them was The Great Evangelical Disaster. The other is contained today in the Schaeffer Trilogy, The God Who Was There. The one thing that he said is, if the church ever adopts this dialectical method he was describing, he said it will lose its capacity to stand as a witness against the spirit of the age, because very rapidly it will be adopting the things of the age. Now, he's not talking about superficial things. He wasn't dealing with music and stuff like that. But having said all of that, the other thing he pointed out is the adoption of all of these trends goes down a food chain, starting with the philosophers down to the academics, and he actually lays out the chain, then down into the arts. And he said the last people to get it are always the church when the changes come through, or people in the churches that are moving in what he would call progressive directions. And progressive, remember, always meant Marxist or socialist. And he said the funny thing is the church always embraces it as something new and great. In reality, it's been around for 20 or 30 years. And that's exactly what's happened once again. So Schaeffer's been proven correct in every stage, but I can still meet a lot of pastors that have never read Francis Schaeffer. We're in the middle of profound restructuring of society. It will ultimately be hostile for the church, and the church that is schooled in the dialectic will not be able to stand in that time, because it will not be able to find solid rooting when the storm comes by. It will always be looking for relationship and friends in the church. And if the friends aren't there or the going gets rough, they'll say, hey, I didn't bargain for this. I'm into a touchy-feely church.
Absolute. And, of course, the whole idea of the church growth movement is to get away from the absolutes. Thus saith the Lord. How do you feel about this? I mean, what's your opinion? I'd certainly like to know your thought and your input. We'll be right back to wrap up tonight's program. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is John Loeffler, and our good friend Barrett Schoes has been reading the manuals that are utilized by the people who are to instruct in the small groups. And, of course, they don't have to be founded in the scriptures. They have to be founded in how you manipulate the people in the small groups, because this is all about corporate management. So what's corporate management have everything to do with the church? It has everything to do, if you're going to change the outlook and the structure of the church, why, you can do it just like you do with a corporation and change the attitude of the individual. And that's what's scary, because they're playing games with the minds of people who don't have emotional problems, but they will have by the time they get through with the program. John, what are your parting thoughts for our listeners tonight?
Well, it's going to be a very wild time. You know, I keep thinking about the arguments pro and con about Mel Gibson's movie and things. Frankly, all of that is going to get shaken out very rapidly here. I think the Protestant church is in for some really wild shakeups that it never dreamed. It's going to find friends and common cause in certain areas that it would never dream of. And it better have the wisdom to understand the times that it's moving through. These are the things that our brothers and sisters in persecuted churches learned early on. And I think the Western church, only in the Western church, where we have full bellies and full checkbooks, do we have the luxury of debating a lot of these fine points. That just doesn't happen in a church under duress.
And, of course, I think you're talking about this division between Catholics and Protestants. And, you know, when you're locked up in a prison for your faith, you really don't care whether the fellow in the next cell is a Catholic or a Protestant. He worships the same Lord you do. And it's so easy to spell out.
That's what Noble Alexander wrote in his book. He spent 22 years in prison, and that's what Wormbrand said. He said it shakes everything out, and you get right back to what we used to call the fundamentals. You know, What is the fundamental of the Christian faith? It is Christ Jesus and Him crucified. And anyone who confesses Christ, remember that. That is the requirement for salvation. All right? It's not a works or it's a theology debate. As a matter of fact, Richard Warren Brown says, one thing that cannot be tolerated in a church under persecution is any theological debate whatsoever. Because he said that results in people being killed, in hatreds and enmities and other things like that. That was the first thing that had to die in the church behind the Iron Curtain.
And, of course, people say that could never happen here. But I'd like to ask, why couldn't it happen here? It happened behind the Iron Curtain because the people there had turned their backs on God, and the church has abandoned God. And I believe the same thing is happening here. In fact, if God is just, His justice cannot sleep forever. And I fear, I really do fear, that one day we will see God's justice imposed upon America for turning away. John Loeffler, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, appreciate it. Don't forget our website, steelonsteel.com.
Well, Dr. Stan, of course, I did the unforgivable. I forgot, John, to put on John Loeffler's website. John, are you there? Why don't you give it just one more time?
Sure, it's steelonsteel.com, and for your listeners, if they want to listen to some of the shows, we won't charge them the subscription price. They can just type in the word liberty, both for both password and login, and it'll work.
All right, fine. Listen to John. He's one of the most entertaining talk show hosts we have out there, and I love to listen to his programs. God bless you. Good night, John.
God bless.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan here, and, of course, this is the time when I have to remind all of our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're primarily dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America trying to get people to understand we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, educational, financial battlefield. Just about any field you can think of, there's a spiritual forces at work there. Our job, of course, is to try to get people to think, to understand how this fits together, to understand there really are secret societies that are demonically inspired and they're working at the highest levels of our society. If you haven't read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, you really need to get it, or you can get it along with a video and audio tape, and it's all the same story. The book actually came from the talk that's on the video, not the other way around, but it's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. It's at its seventh or eighth printing now, so it's been fairly well accepted, and we're just hoping and praying that people will read this and this book will touch their lives. And then, of course, we talk about the church growth movement. If you have not yet seen the video, Diaprax, that's D-I-A-P-R-A-X, Diaprax in the Church. It gives you the background of this entire movement. It's all about manipulation. How do you manipulate Christians? How do you get rid of the dissenters? How do you make their lives miserable? Gee, that doesn't sound very Christian. But this is not a Christian approach. It's a management approach. It's a corporate management approach that is taking over the Christian churches across America. Diaprax in the Church, our four-tape set on the church growth movement. And if you get that, of course, you'll get a certain amount of our written material along with that. The video, Megiddo, the March to Armageddon. My video, Iraq, the Untold Story, comes with or without a syllabus, but it's important you understand that all of the wars of the last century were contrived. They were not fought to be the war to end all wars, to make the world safer democracy. They were fought to bring about the New World Order and the New World Religion, which has always been the goals of the secret societies and the ancient mystery religions that are manifested by the emblem on the back of the dollar bill, the pyramid, capped by the all-seeing eye, the symbol of the ancient mystery religions, hidden in plain sight where you see it every day. If you want to know more about it, of course, we have a book on the Great Seal of the United States, because that's where it came from. It was put on the back of the Great Seal, hidden there from 1782 until 1935, when it was put on the dollar. And there's so much more. We could mention my video of the best enemies money could buy, my interview with Professor Sutton. Professor Sutton's no longer with us, but his video is there, and tremendous amount of information, the book by Professor Sutton, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. After all, somebody has to fund the communists. Somebody had to fund the North Vietnamese. The Russians didn't have the money to fund that war and keep it going for 10 years and purchase all the weapons that were used to kill our boys. who funded the whole thing, you want to see the video or read the book or preferably both, The Best Enemies Money Can Buy. Well, this is the time we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers. We ask you to pray for revival, because if the American people don't turn back to God, do you honestly believe that there would be any reason why God won't bring his vengeance upon this country? And lastly, of course, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until Monday, when we'll be back with you, tomorrow we'll be playing some rebroadcast, but we'll be here again on Monday, Dr. Stan saying good night, and may the Lord be with you.